Okay, so I actually kept the first three slides from last year's talk because they are in fact exactly the motivation for what we did over the past year. And since not all of you were there, I will just refresh your memories about that problem. So there's provenance all over the place. And we talk about this as the provenance in the wild, because a lot of the solutions to provenance assume that either you'll use my workflow system, or you'll use my operating system, or you'll use my BioLite system, or you'll use my language, or you'll use my database. But the message that you keep hearing is you have to change the tools you use and use my stuff, and then you can have provenance. And sometimes that works. But actually, people have lots of infrastructure of tools and things that they're already using. And so the question is, what does it mean to collect provenance when you have no idea what data you're working with, what the operators are, what environment you're working in, what language, et cetera, et cetera? And the question we wanted to ask is, can you actually do anything in that environment, or should we just throw up our hands and give up? We have not given up. So let's look at what people do in the wild. Right? So they use data in lots of different formats. So they have flat text files. They have files that their simulators have produced, which are, they look sort of like flat text files, except they have lots of structure in them that they imposed. They use data sets that they download from websites. I'm seeing lots of nodding, and that's good. Right? So they use all kinds of data formats. They do everything from download libraries to write their own applications to run other programs. So they use all sorts of code that you don't control. Shh. And they move data around. So this is something that like the database people and the workflow people kind of like don't talk about. But people like copy files, they rename files, they move them to different machines. And in most environments, the provenance is just totally gone when we do that. And we'd sort of like to avoid that. And then, heaven forbid, they actually like install new software. So in the light of all this, you know, shall we just go up and give home? Go home and give up. There we go. So last year, this is where we get to the end of the old talk, I said, here's what we're trying to do, is we want to build some sort of architecture that would let everybody capture and collect provenance in whatever environment they want. And, you know, we're going to have to give something up to accomplish that, but here's what we want to do. And so the vision is that you'd have all sorts of applications. Those are the pretty stars, because those are the only things users care about. Right? Users do not care about languages or databases or operating systems or anything like that. They care about the stars. Right? And those stars are implemented in lots of different languages. And so what we want to do is we want to have some library that helps you with provenance that could talk to any of those languages. And oh, by the way, users don't like whatever database you chose. So you guys chose SQLite. Some user doesn't like that. They don't like SQL. They want RDF. They use MySQL. They don't like Oracle. They use PostgreSQL. Whatever. They want to put their own database in there. And so this is sort of the goal that we would like to achieve. So let me tell you what we've done in the past year. So we've implemented something we call the Provenance Library. It's in C++. We have language bindings currently in Perl, Java, and C. And the reason that those are in Perl, Java, and C is because we're working with some folks from the Systems Biology Institute, and they do all their scripting in Perl, and so we are hoping to convince them. So that's why we did Perl. We did Java because Peter is a Java programmer and he likes Java, and also because our test case is all in Java, and we did C because that's easy to talk to C++. And of course, you can talk native C++ too. So we have it is multilingual. The gold coin that we really want is R. That's sort of next on our agenda. We really, really want to do R, and we think we know how, and there's actually a couple of steps along the way. We have implemented a couple of different database drivers. So we have an ODBC driver, which means you can hook in your favorite relational database. And so we currently have that talking to both MySQL and PostgreSQL. So pick your database, bring it in, it kind of works. We also went ahead and wrote an adapter for Sparkle RDF, and we used that to talk to ForeStore. I always pronounce wrong. Okay, and so that's what we've accomplished. Oh, and then we have some use cases. So I'm going to talk a little bit about something called GraphDB Bench, which I'll tell you a funny story. Since Peter's not here, this is how I get to bust on him. And then we also took the Kepler workflow engine, and we basically replaced its provenance handling with the CPL, our core provenance library just to see if it would work, and it does, and it's easy, and it took us like a day. So we think we've got an architecture that actually works in a lot of places. So why do we think this is a good idea? Well, basically, we think that heterogeneous environments are the norm, and that if we really, really, really want the rest of the world to start using provenance, we better give them a solution that works in their world. And in some sense, I think your talk was great motivation for that, because what you have done is said, here's the world the biologists are working in, let's give them a tool that works in that environment. And I think that's eminently practical. You know, I'm more of a systems guy, I don't have one class of users, I have lots of class of users, so I'm trying to go even more general. But I think it's exactly the same philosophy, which is, you know, we've been trying now for a long time to bring users to our provenance systems. Let's try to bring provenance to their systems. So that's really why we think this is a good idea. And there are some interesting things that you can do, is that we can span multiple environments. So if you do some of your analysis in R and some in Python and some in Prolog, heaven forbid, you know, you could actually tie all those things together. So we think that's a win. And it also be, you know, there's a downside. We are going to ask people to do some more work than just by giving them a full environment that works. But what it means is they can actually add more semantic information. So sometimes they know things that are not observable to the workflow engine or the database or the operating system, and we're giving them a way to expose that to us. And we think that's good too. You know, and it means that if you want to hook this into your compiler and extract some static dependencies, you can do it. If you want to do dynamic dependencies, you can do that. So there's a lot of things you can do with it. So our mantra that you'll hear me talk about all the time is bring provenance to the users rather than bring users to the provenance. And I feel like I should have a little soapbox and like signs and everything. You can laugh at that. Come on, I know it's after lunch, but I'm working here. Thank you. So what does it look like? So this is a library. You have to code to it. We have coded some things, but you would have to code your own stuff. But what I want to convince you of is that it's really easy. Okay, it does not take long. So what you do is your program, when it starts up, it attaches to the library, and you get a handle. And then whenever you feel like it, you can create objects. So you can create provenance objects that map to whatever your objects are. If you're dealing with files, great, you can map a provenance object to a file. If you want to deal with tuples inside that file, you could do that. We haven't done the following, but you could actually imagine creating a provenance object that matches a query on the database. So if I wanted all the rat genomes, maybe I could do a query on the database, get all those, and bind those to an object. We haven't done that yet, but I think the pieces are there to do it. So you create these objects, and then if you've already created the objects, you can look them up, and I'll get to naming in a second. And then you disclose data flow and control flow. So you can say, you know, this data flow, you know, object, data from this object flows into this other object, and you can also expose control dependencies. And then you can take any of these objects and annotate them with all the properties you want, and you can think of properties as, guess what? What did you hear in the last talk? Key data pairs. So that's what properties are too. And then when you're done, you detach from the library. That's it. And what this turns into in reality is that wherever you have the equivalent of like a read or a write operation, you add a call to our library. And so all of you are fine software engineers, I know that. And so therefore, there are a very small number of places where you actually do reads and writes in your analysis programs. And so there are actually a small number of places that you actually have to add calls to the library. In our experience, this has actually been the case. Naming is always fun when we're trying to draw data from multiple places. And so our goal here was to enable interoperability between different kinds of applications in a way that felt sort of natural. So our names are hierarchical in the sense that when you create an object, it goes to a namespace. And the way to think about a namespace is it's the application that is creating that name. So your database is a namespace. And so it can choose its names from within a database namespace. Your operating system might think of the file system as its namespace. Your bio application might think of, you know, I'm running my bioanalysis program. That can be its own namespace. So whoever is going to be responsible for defining a set of objects and attaching provenance to them gets to define a namespace. Then within the namespace, you get to define a local name. So what am I going to call it? Well, it's, you know, database foo table bar Rosie. And so you could create names that look like that. So within a namespace, you're responsible for creating unique names. And then you can also attach types to them. So if you want objects with different types. And then finally, we will keep track of versioning. So sometimes, it turns out you can write programs that create cycles in provenance. And if you think about provenance and cycles, it's really bad. So we use versioning to differentiate. You can also jump in and tell us things about versioning. So for example, how does your standard text editor work? Text editor reads a file, creates a copy, you make edits in the copy, and then it moves that copy into place. This is how your traditional text editor works. Now, any normal system that doesn't know anything about text editors is going to see that there are these multiple copies, and then you change its name, and they're not going to realize that what you've done is just created a new version of that original file. And we want to be able to expose that. So not only will we do versioning automatically, we will let you tell us and say, actually, this new object that I created and I'm about to rename, it's a new version of an old object. So if you have things like editors in your workflow, we can take care of that too. All right, so that's naming. There are some other things we capture. So when you create objects, we actually capture the MAC address of the machine on which you're creating it. So we have network unique IDs, so you can actually share provenance across the network. And so even if you have two instances of the same application running on two different machines, we can still differentiate the provenance from those and link them together. So I can take an object created on my machine, pass it to your machine, you can do some derivations on it, and we can still track the provenance back and forth across the machines. So that's kind of cool. And then there's this really fun topic called provenance of provenance. And if you're not careful, you get turtles all the way down. So particularly, we had all these talks about security. And in that domain, one of the things you really care about is the provenance accurate? And part of that is, well, who do I believe? Right? So maybe I believe my applications, but I don't believe your applications. In order for me to make those kind of decisions, I have to know who attached the provenance. And then you might say, well, who told you who attached the provenance? And then you might say, well, who told you, et cetera. We only keep one level of this, but we do keep track of who is it that actually wrote the provenance. And that might be at the level of a process ID. You know, if we allow user annotations, it could be the ID of a user. But we do go one level and try to keep track of where the provenance came from. And, you know, you have to cut it off somewhere. All right. So, and the cool thing about provenance of provenance is that lets you capture these things you might not have thought about, like what size Java heap did I run with? And so it turns out we get that too. Now, why is that relevant? Well, it's relevant because the place that we use this, so here's the funny story where I get to pick on Peter a little bit since he's not here. And other people in the group can go tell him that I did this. So we actually built this because we were working with some systems biologists, and we were writing a proposal together, and we got really excited, and so we cranked out a first version of the library. And then the proposal didn't get funded, and their people got diverted, and so they didn't end up using it. And he's like, well, you know, I really wish people were using it. And I said, so, Peter, you've been working on this graph benchmarking for a while, and we're collecting lots of data and running lots of analyses, right? He's like, yeah. Are you using the library? Who wants to guess what the answer was? No, yeah. So he was properly humbled, and so he then proceeded to go and integrate the library. And so the good news is that it took a day or two. And then the sort of bad news that became good news is one of the things he discovered, which we sort of knew but hadn't articulated, is that we move files around, right? So we do a bunch of analysis, and then we bundle them up, we create a new directory, and we move it around. It was like, well, how do you capture that easily? Because we do a lot of this manually. So we actually created this very, very simple command line utility that does nothing other than talk to the library, and we use that when we want to copy stuff around. So we can now write shell scripts and put calls into the library every time you create directories or move stuff around. So we actually have total end-to-end provenance on this database benchmarking suite we have. And the good news is it's been fabulous. So, you know, the students will walk in with graphs and we'll look at them and I'll say, but wait a minute, you know, you told me this a week ago and now you're telling me this, why are these results different? It's like, oh, hold that thought. Type, 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 query the database, you get the provenance back and you can figure out what happened. So we've used it both to debug our scripts. We had a case where we thought we were running in a Java heap of a different size. Lo and behold, you look at the provenance and you realize that, oh no, we forgot to fire up the Java heap with the right size. So we've used it in our own debugging. We've used it to explain our results. And it kind of does all the things that we've been telling people provenance does. And it does it in this environment, which is a combination of Java and shell scripts and GNUplot and Dot and sort of every other tool that you can think of that you use in generating papers. That's all part of our analysis system, and we capture all the provenance for it. And it, you know, was under a week's work by this guy to sort of go through the whole pipeline and figure out how to do it. So it's kind of cool. I'm actually trying to use it in some other stuff that I'm doing. And of course, when I tried to compile it on an old version of macOS, not Lion, we had problems. So we're actually using it on a day-to-day basis and making sure it really is portable and bilingual and all these other things. So in perfect time, I have 1 minute for discussion, which leaves you no time to say anything. So a couple of the reviewer comments, like, won't this free-for-all just lead to garbage? And the answer is that some provenance is better than no provenance. And it is possible you get garbage. But let's step back for a minute. How is it that you would get garbage? Somebody took the time and trouble to annotate their stuff to add provenance, and then they took the time and trouble to do it badly. Okay, it's possible, but we actually think users who care about provenance are actually willing to take the time to do it right, and that if it's wrong, they'll notice it's wrong and fix it. So yes, you can write garbage into the provenance database this way. That doesn't worry us too much. We actually think people will do the right stuff. Okay, but what about people, you know, what if you run programs that haven't been annotated and they have missing provenance? See, point one, some provenance is better than no provenance. And there's nothing that says when you're writing your tools, you can't ignore some of the intervening steps and still refer to provenance in earlier places. So because of the way the CPL is structured, you can actually ask about other parts of the system, and you can actually connect your provenance to other people who collect provenance. So if there are pieces you're using that don't, you can fill in for it. You can say, okay, I just called this program, which, you know, is too lame to add any provenance, but I called it, here are my arguments, and here's what the data flow is. So you can sort of accommodate some of these programs that are too lazy to give you provenance. So that's the library. This is also an advertising pitch. We've got it up online. I meant to put the URL here, and I didn't, and that was really stupid. But we do have it up online in a public repository, and if you have any interest, please send me email and I'll send you the link, and please use it, because it kind of works. Questions?
Hi, Margot. This is very nice work. It's good to see a provenance system actually up and running that I can play with as well.
Oh, there's a second one. We did an operating system, but nobody wanted to use it.
I'll definitely try this one. So my question is, you didn't talk so much about how the programmer or the user actually defines provenance and what kind of provenance information he or she is able to
add into the system. It's just that it's dead simple. Okay, so you're a programming languages guy.
Yeah,
so,
I was curious about, you know, how do you define these things and how do you, yeah.
So you get to decide. So here's two things you might do. You might decide that your provenance objects are functions. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. you could say, okay, I have a function stircompare. Mm-hmm. And every time I call stircompare, I will add data flow that says, this variable and that variable. You know, the output of my stir compare is dependent upon these other two functions.
But then how do I then query this information? So this information is stored in some kind of a database.
Right, and you've given us names. You've decided how to name your stuff.
Oh, I see. So I can literally write database queries to actually...
Well, we have a query language, we have a visualizer, so we have a bunch of stuff that sits on top of the library that lets you look at it. But okay. Conceptually, the way to think about it is you can then write queries against the database.
Proven anything about the completeness or soundness of the query language what kind of properties do we expect?
Okay, so our path query language, you'll be happy to know, we actually have a formal semantics written up.
Is the semantics written in C++?
No. So I am not a languages person. I don't even pretend to be one. We work with language people. And my staff person who does it claims to know something. So we have this thing called the path query language. It has a semantics. In terms of completeness, No, he has not written the proofs. That's one of the things that he keeps putting off because it seems really painful. Mm. So we can't prove anything. We believe, we know based on some other work that it's more powerful than most of the other graph query languages out there. So in particular, you can, in the query language, express what we fondly refer to as the Kevin Bacon query, but which is really a shortest path query. So you can actually express shortest path queries in a query language, which is kind of cool. It's a work in progress. We don't know how to write it up in a way that people understand what we're doing.
But in the prototype implementation that you have, can I try out some queries and
see? Yeah, so we do have Pickle. I'm pretty sure we have Pickle bound to this. Yes, I'm pretty sure the answer is yes. When you download the library, I don't think that's included, so we'll have to talk to you to tell you how to hook them together.
I'm very curious to see how this works out.
Yeah, but we have hooked it up to Orbiter, which was the visualization thing we talked about last year, and we've also done some other work on visualization that we'll be hooking up.
Yeah, thank you.
Possibly one quick one for who's giving the second talk?
Philip. Yes. There he is. Actually, why don't you come up? We can do the laptop swap.